Accession number 11522, reel 2.
Reel 2. Yes, you were saying about the attitude of the friends that you found so wholesome.
The thing about them was that they made no requirements of you. You didn't have to subscribe to a formula of belief. But they cared a lot for you individually. It wasn't that they were careless of you. They were very concerned for you. But they didn't want to circumscribe you. They had their own testimony, of their peace testimony, as they call it, and of course one knows their record over the centuries of being involved in the promotion of peace and the diminution of conflict worldwide. And I felt it was a religious, and this all springing from a religious motive. And it chimed very much with the kind of childish strivings I'd been making still at school and subsequently to make some sense out of religion. It was a very natural place for me to find myself.
Well, were you given, you say you had the support of a group belonging to the PPU,
yeah,
and the Friends.
Yes.
When war started, were you given, as a young man, liable for conscription, were you given advice by the Friends or the PPU, how to handle this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you were active, you were helping develop, I won't say advice, but lines of action which you would take and wouldn't take and so on. But this was a collective thing. I mean, of course you looked to older and wiser people, some who'd been conscientious objectors during the First World War, and whom one admired enormously and respected, and some who are MPs now, and some who had then moved out into penal reform, like Fanny Brockway, and people like that. So these were figures that you would honour and respect, and whose writings you would absorb. But they weren't individual advice given to you as a person. You got the collective support by meeting weekly and discussing issues and engaging in, as I say, things like the refugee movement. If you wanted advice, then of course you would take the initiative and you would approach a wiser person, and indeed I was greatly helped by a couple of Elder friends, Morris and Maud Rowntree, who he'd been a conscientious objector during the First World War. She'd been very active in relief work in Turkey through several earthquakes and stuff like that. And they took me into their home for a year or something like that. I was living in digs on my own. But there were no pressures put on me. And that was a very good experience because I could look to them for advice and support and help and so on.
Did you know about the Friends Ambulance Unit?
Yes, I did.
Yes. Did that attract you in any way? Did you consider?
Well, there was one basic objection to it, in a way. One was that a willingness to engage in the Friends Ambulance Unit, from my viewpoint, recognised the legitimacy of war-making. It may seem an extreme position, and indeed it was. I was what in those days was called an absolutist. I knew people who joined the FAU and, of course, honoured them and respected them. And I had read, writings of people in the First World War who'd worked in the Friends Ambulance Unit in that war. I didn't feel a particular call towards it, and I felt that I wasn't prepared to join in the machinery of war making, even to the extent of being told that I could be exempt from military service provided I joined an ambulance unit. So that's why I didn't join the FAU.
I must ask you now, Did you register as a CO?
No, I didn't, but for the same reasons. I I took the view that if I registered and sought exemption in a normal way, I was subscribing to the pattern, the organisation of war. I mean, the government was liberal, enlightened, in providing that opportunity for people like me. I recognised that, of course, and I contrasted it with what would have happened if I'd been in Germany. Of course. But that didn't alter the fundamental principle that seemed to me to be important at that time. So I didn't register, but of course I wrote to the authorities saying I wasn't going to register, and this was my name and address. With the inevitable outcome, of course. As it turned out, I had, by this time, gone off to a Quaker college in Birmingham. And one night, the police arrived on the doorstep after the Blitz on London had begun with an arrest warrant to take me back to London. It turned out later that a summons had been issued and posted to the Birmingham police, but of course in wartime the post often went astray, as did this. So nobody in Birmingham knew I was to be in London at a certain court on a certain day. So the police arrived. And we had a hilarious journey back to London because, as I say, the Blitz was on, and when we got to within about 10 or 12 miles of London, there was an air raid on, and the train stopped and so on. And finally arrived in Paddington at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and this we had to go some miles. And this policeman and I, who'd had a very interesting conversation in the train about pacifism and war and his job and so on, we found no means of transport, no underground, no buses and so on. So we went in opposite directions, each looking for a taxi to take us to the police station where we were due, and ultimately found one and joined up again, and he took us to the police station. And I appeared in court the next day and was remanded in custody because nobody then knew that the summons had gone missing. They thought I was just an absconder who hadn't answered the summons. So that gave me my first taste of prison, which was...
How were you treated in court, you know, before you...
Well, in a very formal manner. I mean, I didn't know about this summons, and I didn't think to ask for bail. Of course, I wasn't represented, legally or anything. And I knew that the ultimate outcome of my action would be anyway. So it didn't seem to be a major matter.
How did you feel reminded. About it, you know, knowing what had happened to COs in World War One, and that you were taking this absolutist stance? How did you know... What was your frame of mind?
The frame of mind had been more kind of fraught in the weeks and days leading up to the decision whether or not to register. Once I'd reached that, then the frame of mind was settled. But that was a difficult time, and it was one of the few times I really prayed very hard to seek guidance about what I should do. I wasn't clear. But I felt, I mean, it's silly, I don't hear voices normally. I mean, I'm not a Joan of Arc or any such thing. But I felt the words "don't register" keep on repeating through the night, or the night before, while I was trying to conclude what I should do. So I didn't register. And at the end of that, my day due for registration, I felt settled. So then anything that subsequently happened didn't have anything like the impact that that decision had had, really.
But the thought of prison...
Oh, well, that was less troublesome.
Well, was it different in those days, though, being sent to prison, than even today, would you say? The stigma of prison?
On the whole, the stigma for conscientious objectors was much less in the Second World War than it had been in the First. The First World War, you had young women going up and giving you white feathers and all that stuff, you know. The marvellous story of Bernard Shaw being accosted by some middle-aged woman in Oxford High Street on one occasion, who said to him, "Young man, why aren't you at the front defending civilization?" To which he replied, "Madam, I am the civilization you're trying to defend." Now, I didn't put myself in that class. And we didn't suffer that kind of indignity in the Second World War. My friends, of course, were all supportive. My family slightly excommunicated me, not my brothers, but my mother and stepfather. It was no great deal. The decision having been made, the prison experience, I had quite a few friends in prison at the same time. I mean, the worst experience in prison, funnily enough, was just in that very first week of remand when I was in the boys' prison at Feltham, which was much less organised by rules and regulations, so the staff were much freer. They didn't wear uniforms and so on. And their attitude to the youngsters, it was called a boys' prison, but it was up to the age of 21, and the attitude to the young people was far more hostile and punitive than it was in the adult prisons I was in. But I was only there a week. I celebrated my 21st birthday in that boys' prison and then was transferred to Wandsworth.
But what were the conditions like in the boys' prison?
I've only got a fairly distant memory of it. I mean, it was the first impact of prison on me, so it came as something of a shock, I have to say. I remember I was very naive. I remember going in the Black Maria from the court to the prison, and we were together in a cell before being loaded up, and some very knowing youth slipped a watch in my pocket without me really realising what was up. Obviously, the watch was hot property, and he didn't want to arrive at the prison handling it. And I was an idiot, and when I was asked to empty my pocket, I did. Fortunately, the question was never raised, but I was that degree naive about the kinds of people I was going to be mixing with. there was quite a climate of hostility from the boys to the staff, for good reason. And I remember the contempt with which the examining medical officer conducted the medical examinations, which you had to undergo on arrival. That was the thing that struck most, actually.
How was that sort of manifested?
Oh, in his physical handling of our body and so on. It was rather nasty. He had a nasty job too, I must say. But he made it clear that you were rather beneath contempt, not because you were a pacifist, but because you were there in prison, which was not the kind of remedial thing that I had read about as one of the objectives of the then prison commission.
How about the other boys? You know, did they know you were a pacifist?
Yes, and that didn't worry them in the least, nor did it in the adult prisons. In fact, on the contrary, in the adult prisons, there was a lot of sympathy for pacifists. Most of the people in the adult prisons were very average citizens. They'd been convicted of looting or something like that after an air raid, a shop bombed, and they'd gone in and helped themselves to a radio or whatever. Fairly minor property offences, a lot of them in prison for. And if you were open to hear them without condemning them, they would talk very freely. And I think appreciated, you know, that you're just like them, just an average person.
After the boys' prison, you know, this is your first spell, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Where did they take you, the first adult one?
They took me to Wandsworth. I must tell you, my 21st birthday was the most memorable occasion I've ever had. My then girlfriend, who I was planning to marry and subsequently did, had to move from London. She worked for the BBC and they'd evacuated to Bristol, and she'd asked her boss for time off to come and see me on that 21st. And the boss refused. So she said, right, well, you can keep your job. I'm leaving, and walked out and came and worked as a waitress in Alliance Corner House for the rest of the time I was in prison. And she brought me a manuscript book that she had written, with all her favourite prose and poetry and so on, I don't know, it took me 6 months to write this, and it's still a treasured possession. It goes around the family repeatedly now. And so I owe Feltham Boys' Prison a debt of gratitude for having elicited that and given me that rather memorable experience. I know it's nothing to do with the adult prison, but it was just something that made my day. Yes. Mm. Right. Go on.
So the adult prison then, this is Wandsworth, you were saying.
Wandsworth, yes, that's right.
Yes, so what was it like going into a prison like that?
It was really a bit horrifying, I suppose. I was only there for a month. It was a month sentence. And it was during the days of the Blitz. And there was bombing every night. And quite a lot of prisoners were very frightened. They would bang on the windows and on the pipes and the doors and so on when the raids were at their house. And, of course, you were locked in. There was no escape if the thing had been bombed. As it was, indeed, some wing was bombed. But one could see, you couldn't do anything about it. What could the prison authorities do? Unless they were going to turn you all loose, which would have been, of course, a very nice thing to do. But they chose not to. That was why. More grievous was an execution which took place while I was there. And that, of course, affected equally everybody, the prison officers no less than the prisoners. But that was the only good thing about it, the kind of united feeling between the prisoners and the officers about the horrifying business of executing people, hanging people.
And how was it sort of communicated through the prison?
Then? Well, there was a tension which was almost tangible. And as the day drew near at night, the banging on the doors became louder and louder, you know, and it rose into a crescendo at the time. I've never approved of hanging, of course, or of any kind of execution. But those who most ardently press for it, I think, should try doing it themselves and try and live in the situation where it happens, and they might take a different view of it.
Would the condemned man have been, you know...
He was in a condemned cell. He wasn't in the wing with the others. He was moved to the condemned cell, I think, probably, as soon as he was sentenced. I'm not quite sure about that.
Did you know when the execution took place? You know, the
We knew which morning and what time, 8 o'clock, it was due to take place.
What happened then, you know, on the hour?
Oh, there was silence and a kind of numb feeling. I think, well, I can't speak for everybody else, but a feeling of grief for him, whoever. I don't think a strong aftertaste of resentment or anything, not least because the prison officers shared in that feeling. I think it wasn't a kind of them and us between the prisoners and the officers on the issue of hanging.
Did they talk to you about it, for instance? How did you know that they felt like that?
The officers. Well, you could see it. It was just visible. And I mean, some would be careful not to talk freely to prisoners because that opens them up to abuse and so on. But it wasn't difficult to know, if you wanted to know.
Did you have a cell to yourself?
Yes, I did. We didn't share cells in those days because there wasn't that degree of overcrowding. And that's one of the ways in which the situation has so badly deteriorated in more recent years. We had a fair bit of contact with other prisoners. We didn't have formal association, as now happens in the evenings for games or whatever. But we were in workshops during the day. I was saying mailbags or whatever, and you were free to talk, and then you were on exercise. And so you had quite a lot of social contact with other prisoners, more than now, in many prisons, because of shortages of staff and all the rest of it, and lack of supervision requiring prisoners to be locked in their cells 23 hours a day now. So in those kinds of ways, the situation has gone downhill quite a lot.
What was your cell like? You know, how comfortable was it?
Oh, there was no comfort in it. It was I don't remember the measurement. It was about 10 foot by 6, something like that. Painted a kind of institutional green and cream. And a table, a plain table, or ordinary deal wood table, and a wooden chair, and a bed, and a window high up in the end wall opposite the door, and a door with a little peephole in it, of course locked from the outside. And in theory, you weren't allowed to stand up on your chair to look out of the window. The window was high enough so you couldn't see out of it from where you were supposed to be. But of course everybody did. And the officers knew it. I mean, it was a ridiculous rule. But that's what the cell was. But one spent... It was surprising how much time you had. You had to open up and slop out. You had to open up in order to take meals in. You had, the doors all had to be unlocked before the meal began coming around. So you had opportunities for signalling to the chap opposite or... And there was a conscientious objector opposite me, and so that when he went, he was discharged before I, and he got in touch with my wife and gave messages. And all this kind of communication went on, kind of informally as well as at the formal times.
The slopping out, you know, what was that? You know, how did that affect you?
Oh, I mean, it was unpleasant, but it didn't affect me more than that. I mean, it's worse now. You've got three men in a cell, and you've got sluices incapable of taking all the material, and the floors getting... Well, we still, in those days, used to get floors flooded, and have, at one time I was a cleaner, a landing cleaner, so I had the job of mopping it all up and disposing of it. It was unpleasant, but it was something that everybody had to share in, and the prison officers disliked it no less than the prisoners. But it's been going 50 years and had been going, no doubt, 50 years before or more. I don't know how long this, since the prisons were built. So I did read that in one prison, it might have been Pentonville, toilets had been put in the cells originally when it was built and subsequently taken out. I read that fairly recently, and that did astonish me 100 years ago. But, I mean... The thing was, not the unpleasantness of it really, but the degradation implicit, that this was a suitable way of treating people, prisoners or anybody. So it established a climate of them and us. Not them and us, but the officers in particular, though the officers had to become the instruments of the management. So they got tarred with that brush. Whether individually they wanted to be or not, and many did not. And it really is grievous that despite all the words and what the regulations say about the objectives of imprisonment to reform it and all the rest of it, the words are continually disproved and have been for 100 years and more by the conduct of the prison service. And it's very sad. And, of course, it's incredibly damaging because it only confirms people in their criminality. It does nothing else than turn out more efficient criminals. Well, I say nothing else. You do get the odd exception. And if I can digress a moment, I mean, later in life I became a manager in the social services. And I was put in touch with a prisoner who had served 14 years or was towards the end of his sentence of 14 years for an offence of violence, who, after 7 or 8 years, had taken stock of himself and his position and had made a determination that he was going to change. And I don't know quite what achieved that, but then started educating himself and learning and concluded he later wanted to be a social worker. And he had, in fact, in one prison, been a key person in defusing a potential riot because he was about the only person who was trusted by both the officers and the prisoners. And he'd become a kind of mediator. And he'd had a Queen's commendation for this. Well, of course, I recruited him subsequently. But he was a very rare exception. Mostly, it destroys people.
How about your food? What sort of quality was that?
Oh, that was all right. I mean, it was plain, ordinary fare. I've never been fussy about food, and it didn't trouble me in the least. Once a week, you got plum duff, as it was called, a kind of mini Christmas pudding. You know, that was a great treat. And it was decently served and as hot as it could be. I mean, the wartime conditions made it very difficult to run a place like that and keep it going. And the food was adequate, and you hoarded little bits for later use and so on, and nobody minded. And we used to put a bit of dope in the cocoa at night, and nobody resented that because it helped you to sleep anyway.
Do you really think that happened?
I think so. And I thought if it was so, it wasn't a harmful quantity or anything. If it was so, it was quite a good thing to do. And of course, there was bits, other things than food. You had the bits of humour every now and then. I just talked about the difficulty of running an institution and with the bombing. And it was very difficult to get a bath. You know, your one day a week was your bath day. And you would be taken out of the workshop wherever you were and paraded over with about 40 others to the bathhouse. And each week it got deferred. There was no hot water. There was no hot water because of bombing. Came the day, you're going to get a bath today. And we were all assembled and paraded over to the bathhouse. And the orderly, the prison orderly, who had filled all the baths with boiling hot water, and there was no cold. So we were all paraded back to the workshops. That was the nearest I ever got having a bath in Wandsworth Prison.
You were there for a month?
I was there a month, that's right, yes. Yeah. But as I say, no one's to blame, but it was just one of the facts of life. But I think, actually, that kind of difficulty did tend to make life between the officers and the or the screws, as we call them, and the prisoners, more bearable. We all suffered from the same problems. Whereas in later sentence, it was less so, and I think there was more potential for strife.
Well, were you allowed to have visitors?
I didn't get a visitor because you had to serve a month before you got one. I think that's right.
How about letters?
I got letters. You would get one letter a week. You would be allowed one letter out a week, too. So my wife and my wife used to write about 30-page letters, which, of course, was allowed. Nobody could control what she wrote. We were given just three sides of a folded sheet of paper with all the form filling on the front and then three pages of writing. And I developed microscopic writing and got in the same amount of words as she got on her 20 pages. So we had a good time. Be prepared.